Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Tonight's broadcast is brought to you by another free thought broadcast that you want to check out. It's The Phil Ferguson Show. It's one part finance, two parts atheism, with special guests and a whole lot more. The broadcast available on iTunes and all major podcast apps. I'm going to talk to Phil and have him tell us what's coming up on his show in future weeks here in just a second. Before I get to that, and then tonight's discussion with our special guest, Matt Dillahunty, I don't know if you heard the news about the Reason Rally that's coming up on the 4th of June at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. They just announced that Johnny Depp is going to be among the speakers from the stage. Now, I heard the news, and it's been picked up by media outlets already. I saw it, I think, in the Washington Post and some other places talking about this. I was watching to kind of take the temperature of this on social media. What do people think? Some people are skeptical about a Hollywood actor. I mean, let's face it, Hollywood does not have a long reputation of providing, you know, a deep intellectual well. You know what I'm saying? You know, you don't see reason coming out of Hollywood at a really high degree. But at the same time, Johnny Depp has a tremendous amount of star power, a hugely talented actor. I find his film career very hit and miss. I mean, extremely hit and miss. But the guy himself, tremendously talented. I just rented Black Mass a few days ago. I like mob movies anyway, and I was interested in the Roger Wheeler murder, which happened in my hometown. And the character that Depp played, Whitey Bulger, was involved in that murder, so I was curious about that angle. It's not a bad film. Johnny Depp is fantastic in it. Anyway, he's going to be on stage at the Reason Rally. Even though he's an A-list actor, this is just kind of my take, even though he's an A-list guy who's got more money than he probably knows what to do with, and he's at a point in his life where it doesn't matter all that much what everybody else thinks, it's still a big thing that he would put himself out there, that he would align himself with the biggest gathering of non-religious people in the world. And he brings, I think, a level of attention that we could certainly use. The 2012 Reason Rally was major, right? But how much was it covered in the media? Not much at all. And what little coverage I saw was mostly just religious pundits like Cal Thomas and other people. I think Sean Hannity talking about how ugly it was and it's the decline of civilization and blah, blah, blah. I mean, how many people really focused on the message of the Reason Rally? That we're about facts over faith, that we embrace science over superstition, that we think rational thought is important, that we should use reason over religion in our private and public lives, that kind of thing. And even outside of Johnny Depp, I mean, the roster is really strong. Bill Nye, the science guy, is going to be there. Miriam Namazi speaking. Kelly Carlin, the daughter of George Carlin, the comedian, she's going to be there. John DeLancey, Q from Star Trek, The Next Generation. He also had a pivotal role in Breaking Bad. Julia Sweeney is going to be there. Mark White of The Spin Doctors is going to be there. Leanne Lord of African Americans for Humanism is going to be there, and many more. Dr. Eugenie Scott of the NCSC, Richard Dawkins, of course, Margaret Cho. You can go to reasonrally.org for details on that, but it's I bought my plane tickets. I'm going to be there, and I'll be roaming around once again with a video camera. It's kind of documenting everything as best I can and enjoying the day at the same time. But Johnny Depp, I mean, that's big news. So help spread the word out there. We'll see what happens on the 4th of June at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Tonight's broadcast is a conversation between myself and longtime freethought activist Matt Dillahunty. He and I have been friends since 2011, and we get together usually once a year on the radio just because he's always a great guest. Going to get to that here in just a second. And again, there's video of this exchange if you want to watch via the YouTube link. I've placed that link in the description box of this show. Want to say a huge thank you again to our show sponsor for this week, The Phil Ferguson Show. And once again, I've asked Phil to join me for just a second. Phil, last time we spoke, we were talking about some of the guests that you have, but on the broadcast that you host, you also talk a lot about finance, right?
Oh, that's absolutely correct, Seth. One of my main goals in life is education, and the show teaches people how to money and how to avoid terrible investments.
So what are we talking about? A few examples of the kind of things that you address.
Yeah, absolutely. People all the time have heard financial gurus tell them to avoid annuities. And one episode, I spent 25 minutes going through the mathematics of how an annuity actually works. I had another show that went over all the details involved with long-term healthcare insurance and why it might not be a good idea for you. And coming soon, I'm going to have a segment that's special on why you should not save for your kids' college expenses.
Wait a minute, why you should not save for your kids' college?
Yeah, there's a big laundry list of reasons why that's counterproductive, and the industry makes money selling you on this idea.
Check it out, The Phil Ferguson Show, with lots of compelling topics coming up and, of course, his entire library in archive. I will include the link to The Phil Ferguson Show in the description box of this broadcast. And thanks, Phil, so much for the support. Greatly appreciated.
Thank you, sir. Have a good one.
You know, from time to time in the free thought movement, you'll see people who are sort of on the speaking roster or who host a show, they're activists, they all get together before or after a speaking event or after something, you know, they get together for dinner and just chat. And usually about 20 minutes into any conversation, one person looks at the other and they say, we should be taping, we should be recording this. I wish this was a show or something. Not because we're saying anything of any great importance, but because it's fluid and it's entertaining and it's kind of fun. And many times it's very compelling conversation. And so that's sort of what the broadcast today is. You know, I don't have a theme. I don't have a plan. I don't have any prep. I just called a buddy. I said, hey, let's just chat for a while and see what happens. I think the audience really enjoys these types of shows. Matt Dillahunty and I have been friends for years. We first met at a Freethought event in 2011. And I'm so fanboying right now, Matt. And so anyway, he's here with us as part of this conversation. Thanks for being a part of the show, man. Great to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me. Anytime you want me, I'm here.
The reason I say that is because he just added me on Twitter, which I don't use very much. And my response was, I am so fanboying right now. And I don't use Twitter a lot, do you? I use it once a day, I think, because I'm supposed to. But I have a hard time constraining myself to the character limit. It's hard to say anything without running out of space.
Yeah, I had to really change the way that I use Twitter. I do tweet, and I will occasionally have discussions. As a matter of fact, while you were doing the intro, I was responding to somebody on Twitter, but it was a question about a video game that we both happen to be playing. I will not get into arguments. I might prod a bit, and then what I tend to do is suggest that, okay, if you want to carry on this conversation, you're going to need to email me where I can type more than 140 characters.
How can you have a conversation on Twitter? I mean, it's just the people who get locked in this feedback loop of post after post after post. It just suffocates the wall. Nothing ever gets accomplished. I don't really get it.
On occasion, I've had some productive discussions. They take a long time. It takes a lot more effort to get to clarity. I originally wanted to kind of use it to teach me to be more succinct because I'm not, as you are well aware. I don't ever give short answers. And it turns out there's good reasons for why I don't tend to give short answers and why I don't like short answers. I mean, you know, I'm agreeing with the Bible in the sense of let your yes be yes, if that's the answer. But when we're trying to communicate ideas, getting the concept across takes more than just a yes. And you know, you have no context there. You're not being able to look into somebody's eyes. You're not able to hear the tone of their voice. You can't see if they're smiling while they say it. There's a reason why we use like little emojis and smiley faces. We have to try to find ways to add context to that.
Don't you find that many times though, people become, if not a different person, they amplify some of the more negative and or positive aspects of their personality when they're behind a computer keyboard. They'll say things, they'll act certain ways they would never do one-on-one. They'll do it on the internet.
Oh, yeah. I know there are people who have, you know, I don't know whether they're intentionally just trying to be trollish or funny, but they will rail and rant and say all kinds of things. And yet I'll meet them at a convention and they are a completely different person. Now, I'm not the most intimidating or imposing character you're likely to meet, at least in comparison to Aaron. I'm also, you know, approachable. I like to have conversations, and, you know, I like having conversations with people I don't agree with. But I think that the limitations on Twitter, the limitations online in general, the more impersonal it gets, the more context disappears, the less likely it is to be a good discussion. So my Twitter's tied to my Facebook. When I have an announcement like, hey, we're going to go live with the Atheist Experience and here's the new telephone number to call in, which is what I'll be doing this Sunday, I tweet that out. And, you know, I'm happy that there's like around 45,000 Twitter followers or something for me, which is more than the show. So it's important for me to tweet that out. If this was going to be live, it would be, you know, hey, I'm getting ready to go live with Seth on the Thinking Atheist and you guys should all tune in. But I don't spend my life on Twitter or Facebook. You know, they're basically announcement forms for me with occasional comments and responses when somebody's like, I just did a video talking about the technical problems at the studio and what is now fixed. And somebody was like, oh, well, will the host still have to wear earphones? And yes, they actually will. That's standard. And I mean, that's the way people do television, and there's good reasons for it.
So you and I are children of the same generation. We were there with wide-eyed wonder back in the 70s when the original Star Wars came out. And again, there are no rules to this conversation, but I'm just going to randomly bounce out because I'm curious. I remember that day back in 1977. We never went to the movies. We just never did, right? Unless it was Disney Fair, you know, the Apple Dumpling Gang or something. Herbie the Love Bug. Dad says, you want to go to Star Wars? And we go to the South Road Cinema. It's at one theater. You know, it's just one. They had one screen. And that was it. And it changed my life. And so here I am all these years later looking at the J.J. Abrams film that had released in December. And I was curious as to your take. Did you give it a thumbs up? Did you enjoy yourself? Did he do us right, you know?
Yeah, I think I can give it a thumbs up. I still remember the theater that I went and saw the original, you know, Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope at in Kansas City, Missouri. It was on Antioch Road. And on occasion, when I'm back visiting relatives, I have to drive by that way. And I don't even think it's a theater anymore. I think it's a hardware store now. But I'll drive by and I'll be like, that's where I saw Star Wars. And there are very few films that I do that. Now, I didn't become like a Star Wars nut who had to have all the action figures, in part because my next door neighbor, he had cystic fibrosis. And because they weren't sure how long he was going to live, in part, I think looking back on it now, I didn't think it at the time, he was kind of spoiled and got everything. So he had all the Star Wars stuff. And so we were able to play with that. But I loved the first three that were released. 4, 5, and 6. I didn't despise episodes 1, 2, and 3, but they weren't good. And this new one, so Beth doesn't like Star Wars, but she went with me to actually see it. She's more of a Star Trek fan, loves, you know, Green Arrow, Flash, superhero stuff. And when we walked out of the theater, she looked at me and she goes, it's just the same damn story every time. And I had already realized that, you know, I watched it and I was like, okay, you know, hey, another big, oh, this time it's a super Death Star and we've got the thing. I have a lot of objections and concerns to what happened in this new one. There were things that felt very, very off and I think in some ways bad, but not enough I still put it higher than episodes 1, 2, and 3.
Whereas I don't acknowledge that 1, 2, and 3 exist. I want to, right? I wanted to like them. I was there. You know, I entered with my heart open. And I just felt like it was so anti, and people are always like, well, it's because you were older. It's because you were trying to recreate that magical moment, lightning in a bottle moment back in the 70s and 80s. And I just don't think that's necessarily fair. There may be an element of that, but I, you know, what was the criticism that said that many people use special effects to tell a story? And I felt like in the prequel films, George Lucas had become the guy who's using a story to tell special effects. I didn't connect with anybody. And
these are the classic stories. I mean, this is all Joseph Campbell stuff talking about, you know, the hero and all of that. So it's not surprising to me that the stories will be similar.
The J.J. Abrams version for me connected because I connected with the people that I saw on screen, despite the fact that this plot was sort of a callback. You know, you've got the dreamer stranded in the desert and you've got all of these other things, the Death Star in another incarnation. You've got all these things that are familiar, but because I cared, I found myself being a lot more forgiving. And as soon as we left, I bought tickets to go back and catch it again on the big screen. Now, again, this may be me trying to recreate my inner child, but I, you know, to go and have a good time, I'm really looking forward to the next one, which I think releases late next year. I'm not sure. I have to go look it up.
Yeah, I haven't checked. Let me ask you this, though. So let's say that episode 7 was released and you were in it at the theater and everything was exactly what you saw, except we replaced all of the actors that had originally been in there. So you don't have Harrison Ford. You have somebody else playing Han Solo. And let's say that he's a competent actor giving a pretty much spot on performance. And you don't have Carrie Fisher. And, you know, you go down that. Do you think you'd have felt as positively about it that way?
No. When those characters appeared on screen, the theater we were in, this was opening weekend, the theater we were in burst into applause. We had a front-loaded affection for, they didn't have to spend time establishing a connection for me. The connection was already there, and it was like seeing an old friend. If that had not been there, we're talking about a whole other animal, an entertaining movie, yeah, but it wouldn't have been magical for me like it was.
And I think that other movie would have had criticism on a par with episodes 1, 2, and 3. Because when I go through and I look at what actually happened in 7, there are a handful of things that while I was sitting there, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just awful. And there were other things that were, this is awesome. And I had the same experience during episodes 1, 2, and 3. I'm not going to pretend like some people do that, like you, that it doesn't exist. That I've done, and you and I have talked about this before, is I've kind of trained myself to try and be conscious of when I am trying to put this collection of things into a box based on one part of it. When I say, this person is evil, I'm actually telling it's something that they did, and I shouldn't try to summarize their entire character. When I say once upon a time on the show, when people would make a horrible argument and we'd go on and everything, and the frustrations would hit, and it's just like, sorry, you're too stupid to talk to. You're an idiot. You're a moron. And I would actually just call them a name. Now, we'd already had an argument, so it wasn't like an ad, you know, hominem fallacy type thing, but it's not productive. And also, I realized we're all stupid. We are all morons. We are all idiots at some time about something. So what good does it do for me to try to encapsulate somebody's entire character with a single label? And it's far better if I were to say, you know, the argument you're presenting is irrational, or you are in this circumstance being moronic, if we want to, you know, stick with the same types of labels. And so I can do the same thing with Star Wars or whatever I happen to be watching or reading, and say there were elements of it that were good. There were elements of it that were bad. I am desperately trying to find the good in as many ways and as many areas as I can. And so if I go back and I watch episode 1, 2, and 3, which I actually have on DVD, it's not like I'm completely ignoring them. I just don't watch them often. I can go back through and say, that's cool. That's cool. This special effect here, this fight scene was actually really well done. I like this character. I wish this character had been a bigger part of it. I can't stand this character. I wish it hadn't. And I can view it not as the first episode of this massive trilogy that, you know, or massive series that has a place in my heart, but let me just look at this movie and all the elements of this movie.
I was online just recently and I saw somebody, you're speaking about painting with an extremely broad brush, and this just popped into my mind. You know, we see a lot in the headlines about police brutality. We're seeing people who are in uniform, wearing a badge, keepers of the public trust, and designated to protect the public, and yet they are, in far too many instances, and I guess one is far too many, certainly, abusing their power, often lethally, against the very citizenry they're trying to protect. And now in the dash cam age and the cell phone camera age, we're seeing much, much, much more in the way of evidence of that. It's much, much more on our radar. But someone was online, but I think it was something along the lines of everybody in a badge is a monster. You know, everybody, they're all killers, damn it, kind of thing. And I think what had happened was they were passionately trying to draw attention to a legitimate injustice, but they immediately felt like in order to emphasize the point, they had to overemphasize the point. And in doing so, they just misrepresent everybody wearing a badge. I mean, you speak to this quite a bit. You and I've talked about this. People trying to make a point with hyperbole, and it actually is self-defeating.
Yeah, the entire talk that I gave at Imagine No Religion 5 in Vancouver was called Hyperbole Will Destroy the World. I actually just reposted it the other day. Somebody reminded me about it. And while I'm not, you know, I'm not always a fan of everything I've done or said, and I try not to be overly self-promotional, which has probably cost me a few times. I do think it's probably, it may not be one of the best talks I ever give, but the content, the ideas that were there and what they could spawn in people as far as changing how we approach things, how we have discussions, you know, on the labeling front, the example that I used both in the talk and when we spoke earlier is when you say the religious right just want to control sex or the religious right just want to punish women. Now you're talking about what their motivations are. And those probably aren't correct. They certainly weren't my motivations when I was part of the religious right. I was, you know, when I was anti-choice and opposed to abortion, my reasons had nothing to do with, oh, I think I want to punish women. I think I want to make women slaves to their biology. And so instead of trying to talk about what those people's motivations are, it's better to just talk about the actions and the consequences and say the religious right wants to implement policies that essentially control sex and make women slaves to their biology. And they don't seem to care about this consequence, whether that's their intended consequence or whether it's a side effect of what they're actually going for. This is the harm that they're doing. And let's address that. And similar.
It's interesting that you would say that. We know when I was a believer, let me back up. We were to some sort of a debate and it was about the abortion question, about choice and whatnot. And almost all of the objections to the religious right and the pro, quote unquote, pro-life crowd was that they wanted to keep women in the kitchen. They want to strip women of their identities and their rights, barefoot and pregnant. It's a patriarchal thing. That's all I heard. Not one person in the entire panel spoke to the real reasons that we were against abortion when I was in the church, which was we believed that at that microsecond at conception that a human life had been created, a life with a soul that could not speak on its own behalf, and therefore we were charged as guardians of goodness, of God-created life, to defend those that could not defend themselves. It had nothing to do with trying to strip women of their identities. For us, we were trying to promote life. And I grieve a little bit that many people who are fighting the fight, it's an important fight, but they're missing a huge shade of understanding, because if they better understand why these people are quote unquote pro-life or anti-abortion or anti-women choice, they'll be more effective in helping to change minds out there. Maybe you can speak to that.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. This is kind of a strategy thing. First of all, you have to figure out what your goals are. If your goal is to change minds, then it makes sense to do the things that's most likely to change minds. That's not everybody's goal. some of the people who are, you know, the on the pro-choice side, they're convinced that they're not going to be able to change the mind of the anti-choice, pro-life crowd, whatever they you want to call them. And so they're not interested at all in doing the sort of things that might change those people's minds. What they're trying to do is get the people who are already on their side even madder at the opposition. They're trying to build the opposition up to be a more obvious monster. Now, they may be entirely accurate about, you know, what the effects of the policies are and stuff like that. So they're talking to a different audience. You know, is your goal to change the opposition's mind, or is your goal to get more people on your side so that the opposition is now diminished in the balance?
Now, you and I have this conversation. Already there's somebody who is sending us links of examples of people in the Christian right who are trying to strip women of their rights and remove their identity. I mean, we know those examples exist. You can find examples of anything had you cared. And there are many examples. None of that speaks to the larger point that we're trying to make here. And that's a challenge I'm seeing out there on the road, in the convention circuit, in the conversations, on the internet comment section.
Yes.
Everybody seems to want to sway hard left, hard right, up, way up, way down. Nobody has room for nuance in these extremely complex circumstances and conversations. And it's hugely frustrating. Much of this stuff does not fit on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, I've been frustrated as well. And, you know, I've done, like I went on Drunken Peasants podcast not too long ago. And despite being a little, I guess, clearer, at least answering some questions, there's some people who still desperately want to put me in box A. And what I'm actually getting ready to do a talk in Florida in a couple of weeks about the lie that there is a secular community or an atheist community. There are many communities, and it is our desire to put everything in one box to say, secular community necessarily means this, and we'll define it in the way that, you know, is consistent with ours. Or if we're trying to explain why we don't want to be a part of this community, we'll define it some other way. So I've posted videos about Abraham and Isaac and Exodus and Bible stories and stuff like that. And in the comments on YouTube, it's, oh, your atheism plus feminist social justice warrior thing. When I haven't mentioned atheism plus, you know, other than responding to people in ages. And so they want to put the feminist label on me, which I'm fine with. I've identified publicly as a feminist, but they have this view that feminism is this list of things. And that is stupidly, horribly wrong. For example, I'll just do two and two. Sansara Taylor and Taslima Nazreen both identify as feminist, vehemently anti-porn and anti-sex work. Myself and Greta Christina both identify as feminist, no problem with porn, no problem with sex work. So to say that, which two of us are actually feminists? Because if you took those same four people, you could divide it to where Taslima and I agree on something that Greta and Sansara disagree with, or that me and Sansara agree with on something that Greta and Taslima. So there's every permutation on that little issue. And because there's not a this is feminism type thing, you know, the you have to abide by or hold these particular positions to qualify, then each individual gets to pretty much define and describe what they're going to put into that box. And when that box doesn't match me, they'll say, oh, well, you're not a feminist, or that I'm using it wrong or some different type, that there's some other label. And that, I just think that far better than trying to label everything and fit it in a box would be to actually discuss it. One of the biggest objections, and then I'll get off this little bent, somebody will say, oh, well, Matt is a regressive left, which I'm not even sure I know what it means, because so many people are using it in so many different ways to point to many different things. And there was a guy who came on my Facebook page, and this has happened several times, where somebody says, oh, on matters of religion, Matt is excellent, but when it gets to social justice issues, he's terrible. And I, without fail, I've asked each one of them, please tell me which of my positions you disagree with and why. And not one of them has been able to accurately state what my position even is Sometimes they get it wildly wrong. Sometimes they miss. So I'm trying to mostly be pretty careful about the words that I use, and they will either get it wildly wrong. They just assume my position is X because they met somebody else who uses the same label who has that position, or they know I'm friends with someone and this person that I'm friends with has this position. It doesn't seem to occur to them that I can be friends with people who don't share my positions. And I have friends on all sides of all kinds of issues. And nobody has ever been able to say, oh, here's the position that you have said you hold and why I disagree with it, without us having a productive conversation to say, no, actually, here's what my position is, or I've now changed my mind, which is always an option.
Are there aspects to this movement that you just don't want to have to do again? Like, if I have to answer this question one more time, here's a great example. Did a show recently on the Ark Encounter, which we can talk about if you want. You know, Ken Ham's big multi-million dollar paperweight constructed in Kentucky. And so I posted a video that I produced years ago called Noah's Ark, God, Giraffes, and Genocide, which brings up the story of Noah's Ark and challenges some of its sort of, the congruity, the continuity, the sense of it all. And immediately, the defenses of Noah's Ark were the same defenses that I heard when I first started this conversation, when I first emerged from Christianity. You know, they're sending me pictures of these dirt formations in the Middle East that happen to be shaped like a boat. You know, this long debunked stuff that a quick Google search would have debunked. And I find myself shaking my head. And after a while, it's like Chinese water torture. You just... No more. Done. Is there nothing else we can talk? Is there no new shade to any of this? Do you ever go through that as an activist?
All the time. There's a reason that I'm doing so. My Patreon project, the Atheist Debates Patreon project, the goal is to give my thoughts on a particular argument and the problems with it and how I approach it and how to go about it. And I'm also doing interviews. I'm also doing debates and debate reviews. And then I'm also doing like Bible stories, because I want to go and take like the story of Abraham and Isaac, like I did a couple weeks ago, and give my thoughts on it, both from this is what I used to think when I was a believer, and this is how I view the story now, and here's the how and why. And the goal for doing all of that was so that I wouldn't have to keep repeating myself. Unlike some people, when I go, like if I do 20 talks, you know, this year at different conventions, it'll pretty much be 20 different talks. I get bored so quickly. I mean, it's like if I try to give the same talk over and over again, it never has the same delivery. It's something about me. Whereas I've seen other people, you, Fitz, you guys are awesome. I will sit and listen to you give the same talk like I'm listening to my same favorite song over and over.
Well, normally what I try to do is, you know, if I'm doing a series of cities, none of them overlapping, you know, I'll use the same material for a season and then post it for YouTube. I've seen you write a speech on the plane ride to the event where you were speaking. That blows my mind. Yeah.
That's how I do most of them.
It's too much pressure. How do you organize your thoughts that quickly? How do you research it in your mind? How do you get there? From point A to point B, boom, there's a speech. I don't think I could.
I have to have the pressure. You know, if I have free time, I find that I don't get much done. So I've given myself extra projects around the house, and I'm trying to, you know, it's when I come up against a deadline, and that's where the rubber meets the road. I have done a live TV show for almost 11 years now. And I live in the extemporaneous. I live in the pressure. I want to do the debates. I have to be thinking on my feet. And if I do my best thinking on my feet, when I cannot allow myself to get distracted by this thing over here or the TV or some discussion or whatever else, then it's easiest. Like, I'm going to Florida here in 2 weeks. I have a rough sketch of the theme. And on the plane there, I will basically create an outline. I don't write it word for word. I don't time it out. I just kind of know how long it takes me to say certain things. And I'll have a rough outline, and I'll go from the outline. It's just a different way of doing things. But you talked about the frustration of having to repeat yourself. We've been having the same argument since before you and I were born. This God question's nothing new, and the stories from the Bible and the Quran and everything else, they're not new. I started the ironchariots.org wiki to serve as kind of a counter-apologetics resource so that I could point people to things. I started the atheist debate thing so that I could point people. Here's me talking about this. If you have something new that's not addressed there, let me know, because that just gives me something new to talk about. But if it's the same old stuff, I don't. But I get in a completely different mindset when I'm on the show. If somebody calls, we declared moratorium on Pascal's wager for quite a while because we were hearing it all the time. Yeah. I've lifted that in part because you can't. I mean, if you're in the middle of a phone conversation with somebody and they present Pascal's wager as like their third argument, you can't say, oh, no, you're done, because we've already talked about that. I just realized that somebody's watching the show for the first time, and I also have learned a lot about changing minds. I actually was talking to David McCraney the other day from You Are Not So Smart. And he was here in Austin. We sat in this room and did like a 3-hour interview. This idea, there could be, let's say, here's somebody who believes something and it's wrong. And four people come up to them. And those four people say the exact same thing. Same intonation, everything, you know, if we could do that, just slight differences between the people. When the fourth one's done, that person changes their mind. What changed their mind? Was it the fourth person? Was there something personal about that where they had a better rapport? Was there something, you know, where there was a connection with them? Was it the fact that, oh, now I've heard this several times and I've had to process it several times in several different ways and now it makes sense? Or was it more of the first time I hear it, this is weird and strange and annoying, and I have a particular filter that I have up in my brain. And so the first time I hear something, it gets filtered to the, this is strange. And the second time I hear it, it's like, oh, that's filtered to the, this is strange. This is just another person who's got this strange idea and I ignore it. And then the third person comes up and it's like, hey, wait a minute. This is filtered into the, this is strange thing, but I'm starting to hear it more and more. Maybe I should change the filter on that. And then the fourth person comes along and all of a sudden it gets through. I don't know. There's many different ways. I'm actually working on a talk on that on filters where I'm using light boxes with different colored filters on it. To kind of give the example of my idea about how the brain works.
I am finding more and more, and I'm just discovering more and more, I'm sure it's probably been the case for a long time, that people defending a specific God in the era, in the age where so many of these specific God claims have been debunked, they're defending a Jesus or an Allah or whatever, but they're doing so with deistic language. It's, well, something happened that created the cosmos, which is not an argument for the existence of Yahweh. Where do you get your morals from? Is not a Jesus argument. It's these are all sort of these weird, faceless, nebulous, deistic angles. And I wonder if this is sort of a retreat position because they can't defend it literally.
Well, one of the things is that the religions that have survived are the ones that are sufficiently vague to avoid exposure. When you have Thor is God and he hurls lightning bolts, and then you figure out what lightning actually is, all of a sudden Thor becomes less plausible. But when you have the God who works in mysterious ways, who can, answer prayer, but it seems to be using nature to come up with a solution, you know, where your God fits in not very clearly, those are harder to debunk. They are unfalsifiable or less falsifiable.
Conveniently so.
Yeah, if you look at it, you could say, oh, it's convenient that it worked out this way. Or you could say, oh, over the course of history, we've had many, many, many different God beliefs. And the ones that were falsifiable have been falsified. And only the unfalsifiable survives. And then you get the ones of the package of unfalsifiable gods, you get the ones that are most popular are the ones that are most appealing, that have had significant social advantages, you know, the tax-free status, or they were the particular religion of the state that, you know, was the empire that took over. I don't really consider it convenient. To me, it's like saying it's convenient that the cheetah can run so fast. It's evolved, and the modern cheetah is, you know, the result of the more successful changes. And the modern religions, I think most of them, are kind of the same way.
Working on this speech, and I can't even decide if I'm going to finish it, because I just, as I put it together, I think this is important. And I also think to myself, everybody who is religious is going to immediately play the he's an asshole card. And it speaks to the power of prayer in crisis situations. I've got someone in my family tree going through a tremendous health crisis at the moment. And I think I'd voice some frustration. You know, they pay the hefty insurance premiums. They rush to the emergency room. They see the primary care physician. They see the specialist. They go through the procedure. They take the medicine. They do all of this stuff. And then in their circles, both personal and social media, there's no mention, none, zero mention of the people who actually brought the science-based solutions to their problems. And instead, it's prayers, 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 please pray, 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 pray. And I'm in this weird thing where, you know, someone had once said on the radio, my tragedy is not your soapbox. And I agree with that. You know, I don't show up at the funeral of someone where someone's giving a message about heaven and make that my last stand, or that my stand on whether or not there is a heaven. There's a time and a place. But if we only wait for the convenient positive times to have the discussions about difficult things, we never have the conversation. So I'm in this weird spot where I think, you know, how do we address this? You know, does prayer have benefit in terms of comfort? How do I address prayer when it may be all these people are hanging on to? Do I just leave it alone? What's the move? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought is you should definitely keep working on the talk, because it's an important topic that I think would be beneficial. And for me, I'm not concerned in the slightest with somebody. If I give a talk and if my thought is, oh, the theists are just going to say, oh, he's an asshole, fine.
Well, I think maybe if I frame it in the way that I don't want their tragedy to be my soapbox. I don't want to be the guy who is, there's a page called, I'm inverting it, I think, it's Start Praying, Stop Cancer, or Stop Cancer, Start Praying, right? And the entire page is nothing but these vacuous memes about how God, please kill every cancer cell on earth. We believe this, you know, that kind of thing. Of course, nothing's being done. This is just some sort of theological masturbation happening here. They're high-fiving and cheerleading while nothing gets accomplished. Is it appropriate then to go on the page, which I did, in a very gracious way and say, can we look at this maybe in a deeper light? This is the same God who, before the creation of the universe, actually saw cancer happen, who could heal it at a moment's notice and does nothing, blah, blah, blah. You know, and so I really do want to make sure that someone else's tragedy doesn't become my soapbox, while at the same time I'm addressing something I consider to be important.
Well, I think you're going to find that some of them are going to be in complete agreement with you, because there are a non-trivial portion of, like, the Christian population who not only buy into the thank and praise God in all things. So they're going to thank him and praise him for cancer. I have members in my family who will thank and praise God for the cancer that somebody got, because they're convinced that God is working towards something greater. And so this is a win-win scenario for God. Beth actually just dealt with somebody on a Facebook page the other day. They were talking about Tracy Harris's excellent example about child rape. And it is, you know, if I'm in a room and I see somebody raping a child, I'm going to do everything in my power to stop that. And yet if I'm not in the room, you think God is still there and God is doing absolutely nothing to stop that. So I'm clearly morally superior to that kind of God. Now, this guy responded and said, well, you don't know that ultimately something good could come from that. You know, God may bless her in certain ways, or, you know, maybe that she's going to end up pregnant from that rape, and that child is going to grow up to cure cancer.
They're doing backflips here, trying to excuse the inexcusable.
Well, basically, they're saying we can't know everything. So we get to just presume that God has a good plan for this. And my response to this guy was, okay, so this young girl gets raped, and you're saying you don't know, she could become pregnant, and that could end up being a good thing. And my response is, she could also kill herself the next day. And then your response would be, yes, but her death may bring awareness to somebody else about God or Jesus or this other thing. So the only way that you can, you know, get this to a scenario where they can't spin it for their God would be to have two people on a deserted island who were abandoned there as children. Nobody knows anything about what goes on there. Nobody ever interacts with him. One of them rapes the other one and then kills, then they both die, like immediately. What good can come from that? I think there's still a way that they could spin that for God. But the key to me seems to be saying, to be pointing this out and asking them, what justification do you have to constantly be spinning this in favor of, oh, God is necessarily, how did you determine that God is good again? And my favorite question to ask Christians when we start talking about morality is, how did you determine that God is the good one and Satan is the evil one? Because if God wrote his moral code on your heart and said, this is good, then God is going to be viewed as good. And if Satan had written his moral code on your heart, Satan would be viewed as the one that is consistent with the moral code. And, you know, in reality, you are using your own understanding of morality to evaluate. And in the case of the God, you are also engaged in some serious cherry picking because you believe that there's a God who could do all these things and doesn't. And in any other circumstance, that person would be a monster. And then you also believe that he's the creator of the universe who saw all this from the beginning and that this is all part of his plan. So basically, you're saying the best plan your God can come up with is for the overwhelming majority of species that have ever existed to go extinct and for people to be plagued with cancer and measles and mumps and diphtheria and, you know, killing off kids left and right, and that we have to come up with vaccines and solutions and cures to try to thwart God's stuff. But he actually saw that in his plan. He knew that at this point we would actually be able to, you know, wipe out smallpox. And so all these people had to die in order for us to figure out how to wipe out smallpox so that people don't die from it anymore. And that's God's plan? I mean, this is not a plan. This is absolutely seeing a plan where there should be no reason to think there is a plan. It's the same thing they do with see design where there's no reason to think that there's design. We see it over and over again.
So I'm having lunch with a guy who's, you know, he's the product of seminary. He's not a pastor, but he's everything but a pastor. And we have great conversations. You know, he's an absolute refutation to the charge that all religious people are stupid. You know, they're all whatever, you know, for now we're back to the generalities. And I hear this quite a bit. They're all religious people are just, nobody's listening. And they haven't met this guy. You know, we get together and we have really rich conversations. Now, you know, neither one of us have really moved all that much, but we came away with a better understanding of each other. I think empathy is a great starting point, you know. But his take is, and I think this is one of the only ways he can justify the unjustifiable, is that this life is just the warm-up. This is a testing ground, right? It has to be difficult. It has to be a little bit of a Rubik's Cube for us to figure out. I think his words to me were, you know, I don't want a God I can completely figure out. Because then that tells me that, you know, he's not all that God-like, the more mysterious he is. And the more I see that I'm not able to understand, the more then I put my trust in him. Then he pinballs off of that to essentially say that no matter what happens in the world, this is light and momentary affliction, as we referenced in, I think, Corinthians, 2 Corinthians. You know, and that's kind of how he puts it all in a box and sets it on the shelf, doesn't worry about it anymore.
And everything is wrong with that. First of all, nobody's saying that you have to completely understand God. It would be nice to understand him at all. It would be nice to have evidence that this God exists. This is the all or nothing thinking that we see everywhere
Well, didn't you reference something, not to interrupt you too much, but you had mentioned something about, it was in the Australia speech that you'd given when you were speaking like God, and you're hand-holding the child, and instead of actually hand-holding, you're dragging the kid through the brush. You know, the child doesn't have to completely understand you as an adult, the depths of you. It doesn't have to have the maturity or the perspective, but it can know you exist, what you look and sound like, and whether or not it can trust you.
Yeah, and you could have a sufficient understanding for that trust to be reasonable. For example, there's going to be a big announcement evidently on Thursday about gravitational waves. Lawrence Krauss is, involved in the announcement, and I've spoken to him before about some of this. I'm not a physicist. I don't understand all this stuff. I have enough of an understanding of the subject, and I have enough of an understanding about some of the individuals involved and the processes that are in place within formal science that I can have a reasonable confidence that the information that I'm going to get on Thursday is accurate. Not necessarily that every conclusion everybody draws from that information is going to be accurate, but at least that I'm being presented with good information. And while there are things that I don't understand, and these individuals could get them wrong, I have good reason to be confident that they're less likely to be wrong than, let's say, what the kid down the street thinks. You know, the fourth grader who wants to tell me about gravitational waves, less likely to be correct. And as long as my confidence level in what they're telling me is proportional or consistent with the evidence and the track record, and I'm not saying this is absolutely the case now because scientist X has said it, which is bizarre, and I would never do that. As long as it's from Hume, the wise man apportions his belief to the evidence, and my confidence level in something can be justified or not. And your friend who's saying, I don't want a God that I can understand. Well, first of all, if you don't understand it at all and you have no reason to think it exists, I don't know how you can justify putting trust in it, because it is now. So here's a God that we don't have evidence for and we don't understand. And here's another God that we don't have evidence for and we don't understand. And he's choosing to put his trust in this one and not the other one. He has no way to distinguish between them. And that's a give-up move. Everything about his position is, well, I can't figure it out, so I'm just going to make a wild-ass guess, or I'm going to trust what the people around me have trusted, or what this book says that I should trust. Well, why did you pick that book over another one? What if the people around you were wrong? Surely, if we're going to start talking about what's real and true or what's believable and justifiable, we need some mechanism that goes by, this is good enough.
What other fires in your belly these days? What else has been on your mind? What else are you working on? What else are you thinking about?
Yeah, so I'm doing the thing about boxes. I had just this minor epiphany the other day about the filters in the brain. It was spawned by the conversation with David. And I started working out. I want to actually have like some light boxes with bulbs and then different colored filters. And I don't want to give too much away. It'll be the only talk I've given with props that wasn't an actual magic show. But it's kind of about what I think about how the brain works when people get information and the way we filter it. Because what we do know is we're wrong a lot, and we're wrong probably a lot more than we think we're wrong. But, you know, we have these, you know, heated discussions about religion or non-heated discussions about religions on occasion. But what we're talking about is two different people with access to the same information, reaching two wildly different conclusions. And when you look at, you know, in the realm of politics where you've got, you know, Republicans and Democrats, they have different conclusions about the world that we're living in. I suspect that their conclusions aren't always radically different, and that what's actually happening is that the conclusions are similar, but they're being painted in a different way. They're being, you know, the marketing people have portrayed this in a certain way. And so you need to get away. If we're both looking at this collection of facts and reaching different conclusions, then we need to set those facts aside and talk about what processes we have in our head to evaluate those. What presuppositions do I have? What filter do I potentially have up that is making sure that, you know, this issue is less important than this one, or this one needs to be fixed? You know, are the hardcore libertarians right that the free market will fix everything? Are the, you know, extreme left-wing right that the free market will fix nothing? And, you know, you need this massive Uber control. Is the far right, you know, correct in the idea that, you know, that there's some kind of mix, or is the solution somewhere in the middle? And are we buying into the lie that the right answer lies somewhere between? It's possible one of them could be right. So I was working on that. I'm doing debate reviews for the Patreon project. A couple more Bible stories. I actually have on the whiteboard behind me is every video the three videos a month that I have planned out all the way through next October. And it started with January's videos. And of the three that were listed on the board, I did, one of them. And then I did two different videos, because what happens is as I'm sitting around here working, something will hit me and I'll say, this is actually more important than either one of the two, or my thoughts are more collected on this issue. I haven't really, you know, sussed out all the details of this other one. So it just gets moved. I don't imagine I'll ever actually run out of content. And there'll be some repetition. I mean, every time I post a debate, there has to be repetition because we're having the same arguments about the same thing. But that doesn't bother me so much. I mean, I don't get as bogged down in the sense that I've had this conversation before, because I haven't necessarily had it with this person in this way. And I'm learning things too. I'm learning more about what seems to work. When we were in Australia and we were talking to those street preachers, I had pretty much an identical conversation with two different street preachers over the span of 20 minutes. The first one, voices just keep getting raised and raised and raised until he's not quite putting his fingers in his ear, but he's doing the, you know, he believe me now, do you believe me now, or whatever. And then right after that, another one of them came up to me and we had the same conversation, and it was the same topic. It was about slavery and God, because that's a really strong go-to for me, because it lets them know that I know the Bible perhaps better than they do. And it's something that's difficult to justify. And the second guy didn't get to that point. Voices never got raised, but it was like somebody flipped a switch in his head. I've talked about it before. He just stood there and stared at me to the point where I had to reach out and say, "Hey dude, are you okay?" And he was like, "Yeah. Oh, well, you're really good at this, but, you know, I believe what I believe and you believe what you believe." And then he walked off. And I've had that same conversation with other people where they have been in a mindset where I'm going to go back and think about this and perhaps end up changing my mind, or at least come up with some new way to do this. I'm keenly interested in how and why minds change. And I don't think it's an act of volition. You know, I had this discussion with David the other day that was, well, he said, "Do you think you change people's minds, or do you think they change their own minds?" My gut reaction is, I don't change somebody's mind. They change their own mind. McAfee. But that's not actually true either. I don't think that the changing of a mind is an act of volition. You and I can have a conversation and I could say, "Okay, Seth, you changed my mind." And colloquially speaking, we both know what I mean. What I mean is, you presented information, I processed it, and my mind has changed. But I don't think you changed it, and I don't think I changed it. I don't think this is, you don't choose what you believe. It's not like, not everything happens at this conscious processing level of, let me weigh all this out and, yes, my new conclusion is this. I can't describe what it is that actually convinces me.
Well, that takes me to an interesting point, because when the Bible tells people, you know, you must believe, it's a commandment to make a conscious choice to believe when as you just said, we don't choose what we believe. You didn't choose to believe in gravity. You either believe it or you don't. You want to take that any further? I mean, is there any point where I can choose to believe in Jesus?
So what you can choose to do is act as if you believe. And that may not be true any either, but I don't want to get into a sidetrack thing about free will, about whether or not you can choose anything at all. But what we really mean when our minds have been changed is belief is the state of accepting a proposition as true. It is the result of having become convinced. What convinces you? It's not a, oh, I am now convinced. It's unavoidable. The weight of the evidence, the way things have been processed necessitate this particular conclusion, or when you get better information and shift those pathways around, it leads you to a new conclusion. It's not like I chose to love someone. It's something that happened to me. I didn't choose to like chocolate ice cream. This is just who I am as a matter of, you know, the way my brain works. I didn't choose to not believe that a God exists. I had no say in the matter at all. Information was presented to me, and that information combined with everything that I already understood unavoidably led to this conclusion that I am not convinced a God exists. And when we look at it more like that, and you could say, or I could say to you, you changed my mind, and that's perfectly acceptable because in that context, we know I'm saying, you provided the information that resulted in this. We could also say, you didn't change my mind, I changed my mind, because you provided information and that information could have come from anywhere, not necessarily you. And something in my head is what resulted in this change. But the only thing that really happened is that a mind was changed. And that's really discomforting to people who think that you have to choose believe Jesus or you have to choose these other things, because it puts them in this position of, I'm not in control of anything. Things are just happening to me. I have no control over when my brain does anything. And that may, in fact, be entirely true. And it bothers some people more than it bothers others. But when the Bible talks about choosing, it also says that salvation is by faith through grace and not of works, and that grace is a gift from God and that faith is a gift from God. So they could argue that you don't choose Jesus, Jesus chooses you, which is the Calvinist idea anyway, that there's a handful of elect, and God actually either gives you the faith God module that leads you to belief, or God is the one who manipulates things such that you can believe. And for someone like you or me, God is not doing that manipulation so that we can.
All right, well, if I'm in a revival service, right? And they're preaching the verse from Scripture, you know, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Believe is actually a command. So let's say I say, okay, now I believe it.
I'm not sure that necessarily has to be interpreted as a command.
You're saying if the belief is already there thanks to the workings of the Holy Spirit kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter where the belief comes from. It doesn't matter whether you pushed this belief into me, whether I chose this belief or whether this belief happens to me, all three of those result in the state of I believe X.
But are we not commanded to believe according to the words of Scripture?
So here's two people. Actually, we'll go four people. This one doesn't believe. These three believe. This one believes because they chose to believe. This one believes because God basically made them believe. And this one believes for some other reason unknown. All three of those people believe. So when it says, you must confess your sins and believe, well, then the only thing left for these three people is to confess their sins. How they came to believe is a separate issue from whether or not they do actually believe. And so there's a way to look at these passages. You could look at it as a command, you must choose to believe. But if all it says is you must believe or you must be in the state of being a believer, that's separate from how I came to those beliefs.
That's profound. I never thought of that.
This is the point at which you're supposed to say you changed my mind.
That's profound. I for some reason, I'd always interpreted believe as a command, but it makes sense in that context, you know?
It's one of those things. It's one of the reasons that I love going back through the Bible. I'm not going to do every story and everything because there's some stuff, you know, and not just ignoring the begats. There's other things that just aren't worth talking about. But the Abraham and Isaac story that I did the other day, there are aspects of that story that when you're a believer and you have doubts and questions or concerns or something you don't understand, you go to the people who are supposed to be experts. You go to the people who are older than you, who have been Christians longer, who are ministers or parents or who you know does tons of Bible study. And you say, I'm having difficulty with this here. And they offer, sometimes they offer an explanation. Sometimes they just, A, it's a mystery and God will sort it out for you or not after you're dead. But when they do offer an explanation, I have something. If we can pause long enough for me to run downstairs and get it, yeah, that I think is amazing and fits this.
Absolutely. Go get it.
So, like I mentioned about the Abraham and Isaac story, Beth and I do antique shopping from time to time. We collect various things. Mostly we just like to go shopping. Sometimes we'll hit five antique stores and come back with nothing. But we were at the flea market after I edited and posted the Abraham and Isaac video. And I saw this book.
Bible Stories as Told to Very Little Children.
And I didn't buy it because it was the one that was at the antique store was in terrible shape. But I did flip through it. And then I went online and found it. This is a first edition. Some of them sell for ridiculous amounts. This one did not because it doesn't have a dust jacket. But the story about Abraham and Isaac in here, it's only two pages. There's basically like two or three pages for each story. So there's the Noah's Ark story and Jacob and Esau, Moses and the princess and all this other stuff. So the section on Abraham and Isaac is called Obedient Abraham. And I don't know about you, but what I was always told was that the story was about Abraham's obedience. There's some stuff that I won't go into that was actually in the video. They can go over to my channel and watch that. But let me read through this real quick because I think we'll see what I'm talking about. Once upon a time, there lived in the Bible days a man named Abraham who always obeyed God in everything that God told him to do. Abraham never asked God why did he want him to do this or why did he want him to do that. But just as soon as God told Abraham what to do, Abraham did it at once. Abraham had a wife, Sarah, but they did not have any little children, and God knew that they wanted a baby boy. So God told Abraham that he would give Abraham a baby boy because Abraham had always been so obedient to him, and God told Abraham and Sarah, his wife, to name the baby boy Isaac. Now already, we're teaching obedience. We're teaching mindless, blind faith type obedience. Abraham is going to do whatever God says, no matter what. We're teaching this to kids. We're also ignoring the fact that Abraham already had a kid by his wife's handmaiden. So we're coloring that story so that Abraham had a wife and they had a kid. We also, I think, seem to ignore the fact that Sarah is supposedly 75 and childless at the beginning of this. So when God brought little Isaac to Abraham and Sarah, they just loved him so much that Abraham made a big feast for him. Do you know what a feast is? Well, it's a big party where there's a whole lot of good things to eat. Abraham loved little Isaac so much that it looked like he loved little Isaac more than he loved God. And we all know that we must love God the most of all because God is love and he gives us everything to make us happy. Here's where the story starts to change. So love came to Abraham and talked with him. And love has a capital L. We've transitioned from God to just love. So it's not God coming to Abraham to talk to him. It is love specifically, and we're going to equate that with God. Came to talk to him to find out if Abraham truly loved God more than he did little Isaac. And love told Abraham to bring little Isaac to him. Doesn't say love or God told Abraham to pick up his son and take him out and slaughter him. Love wanted Abraham to bring little Isaac to him. Now, God did not really want Abraham to give up little Isaac, but love just wanted to see if Abraham would truly give up little Isaac to God, for love only meant to show Abraham that God was the true father of little Isaac and was taking care of little Isaac all the time. Now, you remember that Abraham always obeyed God, whatever God told him to do. So when love told Abraham to give him little Isaac, just guess what Abraham said. Why, he said yes, he would bring Isaac at once to God. So you see, Abraham really and truly did love God the most. There's more, and it gets worse.
I'm reminded of that 80s John Carpenter film starring Roddy Piper called They Live, where hidden under all the messages are other messages that just say, obey, sleep, right? I mean, that's the message. Obey, stay asleep, don't challenge, don't be curious. Don't speak in your own voice, but allow us to do the speaking and thinking for you.
So this, all of my other books have been shelved temporarily because I'm reading this book and taking notes, and these will be folded into the future Bible stories that I do on this, and also compiled as a, this is how religions talk to children. And somebody who's been raised in religions and have had this type of message drilled into them, when you come and say, well, don't you remember that story was about obedience? Of course it makes sense. You've heard it before. You heard it from the time you were a little kid. And so the things that were confusing is you heard the story one way that was not horrific, that wasn't about killing someone, that was just about love, 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 and obedience because God gives us feasts and everything. And then as you get older, you learn more about what the book actually says, but you're viewing it under that filter of what you were taught before.
I did the same thing with Noah's Ark, right? What a beautiful story. Lovely animal. Ken Ham's doing it right now in Kentucky. Lovely animals, including dinosaurs, and a story of forgiveness and redemption, and God gave us another shot. It's only later on, with a more honest eye, that you're picturing the corpses bumping up against the ship as the entire planet is flooded, you know? And it's hard to reprocess what you had assumed since your earliest years. It's hard to refocus on that story, see it with new eyes, you know?
Yep. When Noah finished building the ark, God came to him and told him to go into the ark with his wife and all his family and take with him two little lambs and two camels and two goats and two little kids and two cows and two little calves. Do you know what a raven is? There were a whole lot more birds and animals. I mean, I understand that anytime you're trying to explain something complicated to a kid, and I also know, just for the people who are saying this, not everybody comes to religion this way. Not everybody's indoctrinated from childhood, so I'm only talking about that.
Yeah,
you have to kind of explain things in terms like that. But my point is that this book is misrepresenting what's in there. It's not just, let me put it in terms that a child can understand. It is editorializing and engaged in a fiction in some cases of what the text actually says. And all this does is set up a bunch of biases and presuppositions, preconceptions, so that when you get to where you find out what the truth is, it reminds me of Scientology. It reminds me of, I'm going to pay a little bit now, and I'm going to learn this, and I'm going to learn this. And then once I get up to the OT levels, that's when I start hearing about Xenu, the galactic overlord, you know, and body thetans and all of that. This gradual building, because you've got so much already invested in it, and because you have now installed filters into your brain on how to process it, the batshit crazy stuff doesn't sound so crazy.
Have you done any research on totalism and how cults and religious organizations go in and essentially remove identity and replace it with one of their own? Have you done anything along those lines?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, it falls into the all or nothing thinking, which is something else I've been spending a lot of time thinking about and probably will do a talk about, or at least work it into a couple different talks. I'm a big fan of the idea that cult is what the big religion calls the little religion, because I don't see dramatic differences. Yes, by and large, even with somebody like Westboro, where that's a fairly insular community, they're not as, to my knowledge, they're not as far down the road to typical harmful cult that you would see, where we've got this community, you're not allowed to, you are no longer a person, you are now subservient to this person, you have to cut off all ties with everybody outside. You can't have a church that goes out and protests and properly have cutting off all ties. But there are those religious communities that you and I have talked about that I think come closer even than someone like Westboro, where they've essentially taken over a town and they have their way of doing things. Trace, have you had, is it Tracy Lockhart?
Lockwood, yeah. We had her on the radio. Actually, I had Tracy on the radio back when she was using a pseudonym for her own protection. She had, I think, just freshly emerged from the cult that she was in. And it was, she likened it like M. Night Shyamalan's film, The Village. You know, I mean, I picture him over there churning butter and you know, they're completely sort of self-sufficient. Essentially, it's slave labor by all the subservience, a hugely patriarchal system, insulated almost completely from the outside world. And those who ever thought about leaving were threatened with all manner of stuff.
Yeah, she told me she made the same reference to the M. Night movie. But what she said was that people saw that movie and went, oh, that could never happen. And she saw it. And it was like a documentary.
Wow. And she told me she watched Seinfeld reruns just to try to speak the language of pop culture because they didn't have a television, didn't have anything. Her identity had been fed to her in some ways, been fed to her by this sort of system. I'm sorry?
She had to learn how to use money because she had grown up without, you know, not, I guess, not entirely the concept, but without any interaction with it at all. So, you know, what's something worth? How does the money system work? How do I manage my funds and my checkbook? She gave a great talk at the American Atheist Convention in Memphis, I think it was, that covered this. And I think it's online if people want to go watch it. She is amazing.
You filed this under the child abuse category? Is this child abuse, Matt?
Yeah. I'm with Dawkins that a large portion of religious indoctrination of children, I think, qualifies as abuse. Is it the same as, you know, is this, it's not all the same impact. This is another thing about packaging. Oh, X is child abuse. Well, we know that, you know, physically beating a child, that counts as child abuse. But we also know that emotional abuse, you know, if you lock your kid in the basement and don't let him out, that's definitely child abuse. And then you get to the something like, if you're constantly belittling them and systematically destroying their self-esteem, I think it's fair to call that child abuse. The problem is when people hear that this is child abuse, they think you're equating it with beating, you know, like relentless beating and confinement. There's a spectrum of child abuse. There's a spectrum of everything.
If you are limiting what the child may become, if you're teaching that you are born without worth and have to receive worth from another, if you just pound the fear of hell into their impressionable skulls so that many of them have nightmares about it even decades after the fact, you have essentially abused your position as a parent and guardian of this child.
People look at child abuse and they're reluctant. So they look at it from the standpoint of how likely is someone to recover and get back to a normal state of being after they're removed from the actual influence. And so for things, they only want to apply the child abuse label to things that are difficult or virtually impossible to ever get back to normal from. They don't want to say that, you know, if you had your kid and you raised him pretty much normally, but from birth, you taught them that left was right and right was left. Eventually, when they get out from under your thumb and they start interacting, they're going to figure out they have been taught completely wrong. And I don't know exactly how hard it is to recover from that, but I think that is one of those things that's potentially easier to fix than someone who's been systematically physically abused or tortured. But it's child abuse. And when people are like, oh, you shouldn't call it child abuse, they think child abuse is only out on this end of the spectrum. And I'm willing to say that I imagine there's a context in which everybody I've ever known was abused.
I'd like to see a lot more of this kind of nuanced thinking, you know, and we're all guilty. Those who think atheists are never irrational have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, just because you don't believe in God, our email inboxes, I'm guilty, you know, things in my life. I'm a total dumbass about it. I look around and I think, what was I thinking? You know, the idea that you come to atheism necessarily for rational reasons or that you're rational about all the other areas of your life, I think we all have to keep ourselves and keep each other in check, right?
I think my biggest frustration is, you know, as somebody, there are many things that have come very easy to me. You know, I understand computers and technologies. I'm very good at troubleshooting problems. I was taught some troubleshooting skills, you know, as an electronics technician in the Navy that served me in my career. There are certain things that I just kind of immediately get. What frustrates me is when I finally get something that has taken a long time to understand to the level that I do currently. I can't figure out why it took me so long. Why didn't I get this? I understand it now. Why did it take so much time and so much effort to figure this out? Because this is what's making me feel stupid. And this other thing over here, which is complicated, which, you know, my friend Joe doesn't understand, but I understood it immediately. But the thing to remember is that there are things that my friend Joe understood immediately that took me forever. And the key is to communicate. Find the people who understood something. Talk to somebody who understood something immediately, and talk to somebody who understands the same thing, but it took them a long time. And I think if you talk to both of them, you can get to a point where you understand it, because they have two different pathways to this information. And the more pathways you have to that, the easier it becomes to understand it. But I don't know why I'm so dumb about some things, why it takes me so long. When it comes to like money and finances and politics, I'm an idiot.
Oh, yeah. Like if someone asked me something about hey, my car is making a funny noise. I'm sorry. I don't.
A really wonderful moment about 2 weeks ago, though. I'm a homeowner finally, you know, in my 40s. I end up buying my first house, and there are a bunch of things I wanted. I wanted wood chop in the garage and other stuff. Then our garbage disposal broke, and I was like, crap, what am I going to do? Am I going to call somebody? I watched a YouTube video, how to fix your garbage disposal. And I also went and looked up a how does a garbage disposal work video. And I said, oh, that's easy. And I went in, stuck a bucket under the sink, took the garbage disposal off, took it out to the garage, clean. I've got an air compressor and a little power sprayer thing. Clean it. Basically, a glass had broken and got in and bound up the gear that turns. Clean all that out, put it back in, garbage disposal fixed. And my wife wasn't as impressed with me as I was, but she was still mildly impressed. So that was fun.
Now, I tried to replace some part of the cooling system of a computer went out. You know, I just got a wild hair. I can fix this. And before it was over, I mean, there's coolant dripping into the tower, and it's just not, you know.
You've got a water cooled computer?
Yeah, I do. It's not, I don't know if it's water or coolant. It's a liquid, and I let somebody else do the rest of the fixing for that reason, because it's not my gift, right? I'm better in the abstract many times than I am in the concrete. I can edit video and do audio. I can produce a show. I can flap my gums. I can play a little piano. There's some stuff I can do okay, but I'm a big believer in play to your strengths, contract out your weaknesses, learn what you can, where you can. But if you're totally shitty at something, I think it's healthy sometimes to say, I'm shitty at this.
Yeah, I'm willing to farm out things. Some things are just more effort than I'm willing to put in to actually learn. Some things are going to be more time consuming. You know, I'd like to know as many things as I can, but there's also a limit. I'm not going to be an expert on anything. When you did the water-cooled computer, did you do that primarily for sound reasons?
If I'm exporting video, I need a silent studio because other things are happening while the export is taking place. So this is, I'm sure, hugely compelling and exciting to the audience, but it's interesting to us. Matt, I appreciate you, man. You know, I don't know, what we do, an hour and 20-something minutes just shooting the breeze? I feel like I could have done another hour with you, but, you know, thanks for being one of the more even voices out there. I really do feel that way about you. We, a lot of times when we're passionate about something, we're shouting, you know. People, they think more literal volume means I will be heard, when quite often I think you become the sort of the defective car alarm that people just become really good at tuning out.
I think we need to take a tip from Teller. can speak and in the act doesn't. But for anybody who's been around him, you know, off stage, as soon as he opens his mouth, pretty much everybody stops and looks and listens.
Yeah,
because there's this anticipation that something incredibly profound or important is likely to come out because somebody who doesn't normally speak is now speaking. We don't necessarily have to go that far. I'm not going to become the mute atheist TV show host, but there's a lesson to be learned there for sure.
I'll make sure to include links to Atheist Debates and the Atheist Experience in the description box of this video and of the podcast. And Matt, thanks for spending an hour with us, and I'll see you out there on the road, okay?
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the broadcast tonight. Next Tuesday's show, we're just going to do kind of a roundtable with our listeners, whatever they want to talk about, whatever they want to comment on, whatever questions they wish to ask, whatever they want to bring to the table. That's what next Tuesday's show is going to be. Then the Tuesday after that, I'm going to have Dr. Harriet Hall and Dr. Stephen Barrett on the radio to talk about alternative medicine and quote-unquote evil Western medicine. That's going to be a fascinating show, which is scheduled to air on the 15th, and I promise I'm not going to move it again. I've had to kind of bump some things around on the schedule over the last several weeks. But it's going to be a great month of March. Make sure and bookmark the show page. I'll see you back here in a few days on the Thinking Atheist Radio Podcast.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.